advocates of democracy in the Arab world often add a proviso: democracy there may not be like democracy here. Take Saadeddin Ibrahim. He's the Egyptian sociologist who was arrested and jailed by the authorities there. He was charged with taking money from the European Union to fund voter education. Professor Ibrahim has U.S. citizenship, and Washington protested his arrest, linking his case to a review of U.S. AID projects in Egypt. In the end, he was freed, and the principle of receiving foreign grants was established. Professor Ibrahim is in the U.S. this spring, and he stopped by to talk about democracy in Egypt and in Iraq. Saadeddin Ibrahim says that what Saddam Hussein did in Iraq compares to what happened in Romania under its dictator.
The close thing to him in the international arena in recent history was Ceausescu, a dictator who overstayed even his dictatorship to the point where a total atmosphere of fear and terror not only prevailed in Iraq and among the Iraqi people, but also among all his neighbors. So that regime was bound to fall. It just needed a tip, a external jolt.
It seems to me that you're using very delicate terms to describe a massive military assault on a country that destroyed the army of Iraq. You think that the regime would have imploded on its own in time without the U.S. invasion?
I believed, as far as 10 years ago, that had some systematic but well-thought-out strategy toward Iraq been applied, it could have brought that regime down without the kind of war we saw. There were initiatives, including my own, to demand that the Arab countries collectively in their summit ask the Iraqi leader to step down. However, the Arab leaders were reluctant to do it because they did not want to set a precedent. Each one of them was more concerned about what could that mean to his own future.
Before you were jailed, you were ostensibly arrested for receiving funds from the European Commission to do work about electoral reform. But you also made some comments about President Mubarak and the succession of the presidency in Egypt to his son, the likely succession. Do you think that's why you were jailed, first of all, for having...
Well, nobody would know for sure, but that's definitely one of the most popular theories in Cairo and among many of the insiders to the regime. The comment, which later on became an article, written article, was made in the evening of the death of President Assad of Syria. And I was getting calls from all over the world. And the question was asked, how the succession will go in Syria. And I gave my ideas.
Now, the succession in Syria, we should say, went from President Hafez al-Assad
to his son.
Yes.
Bashar. Mm-hmm. So I was asked by several, you know, would that happen in other Arab countries? And to that, I said, yes. It seemed that will happen in Iraq, in Libya, in Yemen. I did not mention Egypt at the beginning, but the callers kept asking me, what about Egypt? What about Egypt? So, well, I said, yes, to some extent it is similar, and to some extent it could apply. And then I was asked to write what the theory was, my proposition was, if I was a time for to hear it, is that any leader who stays in power for more than 10 years develop a sense of property of the country. Mm-hmm. And as an private property, he feels that his children, his family, are entitled to inherit that property. And therefore, the lesson is, and for the future, never to allow any president to stay in power more than 10 years or 8 years, like it is in the United States.
The consequence of the situation now, you say, is this odd phenomenon of creating new contemporary dynasties.
Exactly. And that was the title of the article in Arabic, Gumlukiya, which is a new word that I carved that combines monarchy and republic. That is something that happened in North Korea and was happened in Syria, and it could have happened in Iraq and possibly in Yemen and in Libya and in Egypt if we don't watch out.
Can the United States credibly bring economic pressure, say, against Egypt, demanding political reform, democratization, while at the same time seeking assistance in the fight against terrorism and seeking and receiving the help of Egypt in tracking down radical Islamist groups. Is it a trade-off in which the Egyptian government is ultimately going to win the forbearance of Washington, since we're more concerned about people crashing planes into our cities than we are about your ability to vote?
Well, I don't see any contradiction between the two. Terrorism is not just an American concern. It is an Egyptian concern. We had suffered from terrorism for nearly 10 years before even the first terrorist attack on the United States.
But what if the first blush of democratic reform is freedom for the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt to operate more publicly and to bring us scenes similar to what we've seen in southern Iraq over the past couple of weeks, more religious politics in the country?
Well, let me first of all put what you saw in Iraq in its proper size. If you take the Shiites of Iraq, first of all, they make 16% of the population. They are a majority. Mm-hmm. And in very honest and fair election, they will probably elect a Shiite majority parliamentarians. However, the ones you saw and the ones who are demanding some kind of an Iranist-style government is a minority of the Shia, talking about probably 10-12% of zealots who would opt for an Iranian style. But the majority of Iraqis do not. Neither even the majority of the Shia do not go for that.
But to go back to Egypt for a second, in Egypt, if there were a liberalization that legitimized Islamism as a political force mm-hmm. in Egypt, would the United States be very terrified by the first signs of the people taking advantage of that liberalization?
It should not. And we have seen examples in Turkey, in Morocco, in Bahrain, in Kuwait, in Jordan, where Islamicists, moderate Islamicists, who agreed to play the democratic game, had a share in the parliament without setting the world on fire. And therefore, there is no need to panic. There is need to engage to make sure that everybody who participates in the democratic game is committed to the rules, is committed to the antidote of the one man, one vote, one time.
One time, meaning that'll be the last election you'll ever have.
We make sure, and you could put that, shrine that in the Constitution, that the army ultimately can safeguard this proposition or this article in the Constitution.
I mean, making formal the Turkish model,
absolutely,
where the army
yes.
comes in
as a transition, at least, yeah. for a period. And that's what happened actually in Jordan under King Hussein. He brought in all the potent political forces to sign a national charter before he had his first democratic election back in 1989. And I was a witness to that experiment.
So you're hopeful?
I am hopeful.
Well, thank you very much for sharing your thoughts and your optimism with us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Sadiddin Ibrahim, Egyptian sociologist, who joined us in our studio in Washington.